Today is Hamilton County Prosecutor Connie Pillage's 100th day in office. She was sworn in January 10th as the first woman elected as the county's most powerful law enforcement official and the first Democrat to hold the office in nearly a century. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Prosecutor Pillage joins me now to discuss what she's accomplished in these first 100 days and what's ahead. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We're glad you're here. I want to get right to it. You've had to deal with several cases of officer-involved shootings since you took office. One in February, officers shot a man accused of charging at sheriff's deputies with an axe in Columbia Township. That man survived. Cincinnati police on March 2nd shot a man after he charged at officers with a knife. That man also survived. Talk to us about your process for reviewing those cases and deciding whether officers should have faced charges.
Well, it is my policy in the office that for any officer-involved shooting, my office gets notified and we respond. In the first three cases that we've had this year, I chose to have multiple people respond because I needed a solid team of people who were trained to be able to go. So I've responded to two of those. It was quite fascinating to see a real police crime scene. It was partially blocked off when I first got to the first one in Columbia Township. But we did get to see all the evidence on the ground. We saw the taser wires. We saw where the man had fallen down. We got to listen to the criminal investigators interview the officers involved. And so our job as the prosecuting attorney, because we're there to determine if there's any criminal liability here. We needed to see what sort of things happened. And going to the crime scene itself was the first step. Second step was to go to the police station and observe the interviews of any witnesses. And then the third is to review any body-worn camera or other video that there might be to see what really happened. And I can tell you, really, in all three cases, we did see the police officers try to de-escalate by moving back, stepping back, they used non-lethal force first. And when that didn't happen, that only then did they resort to firing their weapon. And I thought that reflected, first of all, good training, good policies within their departments, and good usage of these de-escalation techniques. Unfortunately, in the third shooting, we saw the death of the man walking on I-75. But would you like me to go into these?
Well, I did. You mentioned this third shooting, and I wanted to talk to you about that one, too. That was a fatal officer-involved shooting. A Lachlan police officer shot a man who was walking along Interstate 75, as you mentioned. He was carrying a metal pole. My understanding is the man who died was a refugee fleeing a civil war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. His family called him an innocent bystander. I know you announced the officer would not face charges. You also met with the man's family. If you could talk a little bit about that decision-making process and just that meeting with the family.
Yeah. So that, of course, was a little harder because, first of all, of the tragic death, but also because of the limited available video. The village of Lachlan at that time was just starting to incorporate body-worn cameras, and not all the officers had them yet. And the officer involved here did not have his yet. But the police chief had already ordered those several months ago. However, there were other law enforcement officers involved because they were trying to find people who had stolen, crashed, and abandoned a vehicle right very close to I-75. So what we were able to do is we looked at three things. First, we looked at the transcript of the radio traffic from the Lachlan officer. And we could hear him say, We could read him say as well, show me your hands, show me your hands. He's got something in his hands. He's not following my orders. I need backup soon. Hurry up, ASAP, those types of things. We did see a sheriff's deputy who was looking for those suspects who had stolen and crashed the car. And he was coming down I-75 toward the Lachlan officer, and he had his camera on. And so you could see the flashing lights on the police car. You could see some a little bit blurry images of the man who was shot as well as the officer. And the sheriff's deputy started running when he started hearing, hurry, hurry, help, you know, those types of calls across the radio. And he was running with his canine. And then we saw the Lachlan officer back up, and we saw the man, Mr. Mumyaritete, with a pole, that metal pole, which was about 3.5-4 feet long, lunge at him with the pole raised over his head as if he was going to attack the officer. And that's when the officer did fire his weapon. So listening to the transcript, pardon me, listening to the radio traffic, looking at the transcript and seeing the video together would help confirm and corroborate the sequence of events. We also know that he deployed his taser, and we are able to get the electronic printout of the record of the deployment of the taser. We saw the taser on the ground, and we had the body-worn camera of the sheriff's deputy, and it was incredibly tragic for everyone. I mean, the officer didn't want to shoot anybody, but he was fearful for his life. He backed up, but he's on I-75. He can only back up so far without risking getting run over.
And had to have been really tough to meet with that family.
Oh, my goodness. That was absolutely the hardest thing I've had to do. I sat down with them. They had an interpreter. They had their minister and a family friend there. And I, in short phrases, told them the things I told you, and that we would not be seeking criminal damages against the officer. It was very hard. The family was devastated. It's really hard to imagine what it's like for a refugee from a country that's probably very different from ours, might have a different culture. Nobody knows why he was walking along the highway. But we do presume that there is some sort of law enforcement in the Congo, whether it's the army or local law enforcement, and that people should know to try to obey those commands, or at least try to understand what the commands might be.
Yeah. Some Ohio prosecutors take every police shooting to a grand jury to determine if officers should be, you know, committed any crimes, should be charged. Have you considered that approach?
Well, I certainly have considered it. I've been starting to network with other prosecuting attorneys across the state, and they've been very helpful, particularly in Warren County and Butler County. And I believe Butler County takes them all to the grand jury. I decided not to do that unless it was a tough call. These three shootings, from my analysis, and I had my senior leadership team look at it as well, we all agreed that these shootings were what we call clean shootings, meaning they were not criminally liable. And we seat a grand jury every weekday for 50 weeks of the year. They indict 8,000 cases a year, so certainly more than 100 a week. To send, I wouldn't send a case that I didn't think had probable cause to them. And that's why I didn't send these shooting cases either.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Hamilton County Prosecutor Connie Pillich about her 100th day in office and what she's accomplished. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I want to ask you about another case, too. A man who was indicted on several charges, including involuntary manslaughter, and is accused of selling the drugs that caused another man to have a fatal overdose. Walk us through that case and what it says about how your office prosecutes crime.
So that's a very interesting case. The decedent died in 2022, and it's been, I believe the coroner ruled it was an overdose of drugs tainted with fentanyl. So lucky for us, we have this heroin crime task force that went to the scene and preserved all this evidence. Now, this year, the drug dealer was arrested on possession of drugs, something totally separate. But because the legislature, when I was a legislator, we passed a law to require the collection of DNA for every felony arrest. So we got the drug dealer's DNA, and it came up with a match. Because the heroin task force collected and preserved and tested this, the drug residue they found at the crime scene in 2022, we did find the defendant's DNA there. And that's because technology has improved so much, and a lot of this is artificial intelligence. We can detect smaller and smaller amounts of DNA, and we can match it with anybody else who comes into the system. So we're able to connect him to that drug sale. And when you ask about how this impacts how I'm going to handle these crimes, that drug dealer, in my mind, is a murderer. He is the one who caused the death of the poor decedent. And he needs to have his due process, and he needs to be tried. And this is how we can start to get some of these filthy drug dealers off the streets.
Do you feel like you're approaching your work as county prosecutor differently than your predecessors? I mean, I guess, as I mentioned, you're the first Democrat to hold the office in almost 100 years. Will the average person notice a difference in your approach, do you think, compared to your predecessors?
Well, it's hard to say what the average person will take from my approach, because most of us don't know what goes on inside that building. But in the first 100 days, I have made some big changes, starting with bringing in top-notch leadership, people who started their careers at the prosecutor's office, went off and did some other types of law, and were eager to come back and serve the community again. Also, I created a training program. As far as I can tell, we've never had a training program for our lawyers. And so they get out of law school, they get dropped in a courtroom, and we don't know if they know how to select a jury or to get evidence admitted. I've got a very long-serving assistant prosecutor who agreed to stay on instead of retire to run the training program, and he's doing an incredible job. The next thing is to bring in some new technology. Not only did we upgrade all the way to Windows 365, and we're still using Word 2010, but we're getting a new state-of-the-art evidence tracking system in July. And that's going to be so important. When we accuse the prosecutors of not turning over evidence, this tracking system will preclude that from happening. And it'll be helpful to everybody having a little bit more time on their hands to prepare their cases better. Number three, am I on three? The next thing I did was create a parental leave program that's competitive with contemporary standards for parental leave. Now, not too long ago, I want to say 10 years ago, 7 years ago, because one of my employees told me she had a child 7 years ago, and they had no parental leave at all. No maternity leave at all. She had
no
to take
parental leave.
None. And that was in the 21st century. So she had to just take unpaid time off. And then somewhere recently in the last couple of years, they created what my predecessor probably thought was a generous parental leave of 4 weeks. But if both parents worked there, they had to split those 4 weeks, so maybe 2 weeks per person. They also put a limit on how many children you could have. You could only use the leave twice in your career, and you couldn't have more than one baby in 1 year. I mean, how do you do all those things? So I made it what I think is very, very competitive. So a birth mother gets 4 weeks of just physical recovery time, and then regular parental leave kicks in for 8 paid weeks. So if it's not a birth mother, it's a papa, he can take the 8 weeks. He can still use Family Medical Leave Act, but it's unpaid for us. But they can substitute their sick leave Well, look, we do have a nice sick leave program, but it's not enough for birth recovery.
Yeah.
You just can't possibly save that up. So just telling people that I value them and I want them to stay here and work for us, this is one way that I can do that.
Will that have an impact on the office's budget?
No, we won't be bringing anyone else in to cover, but we spent quite a few weeks looking at how this would impact daily operations. Could we make sure we got to staff 30 courtrooms in the courthouse every day, and we have restructured a little bit to create some floater positions who can fill in, and that will help us do that. Mm-hmm. So, but having people that want to work here who bring skills and talent and a passion for service, how can I get them if I don't provide benefits like this? I can't get them with a pay raise because I have a limit on how much I can pay.
Right. Have you been talking with constituents about the office? I guess I wonder what you're hearing from people in the community about what they want to see, if they're telling you they want to see something different.
Well, in the community, I've heard a broad range of things. You know, certainly I've met with multiple law enforcement agencies and support groups. They want to make sure I don't have two heads. I think they're all pretty satisfied with that. They want to make sure that I'm accessible. I think people also want to protect their communities. They want to be able to walk out to their car at night. They want to be able to walk from their car to a restaurant or a store when it's dark out. They're worried about safety. You know, we do hear a plethora of events about unsafe actions and crimes that get committed, but they're pretty small compared to the 830,000 people who live in the county.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people are just worried about safety. They're worried about justice. They want to make sure that we do the job correctly and we don't cheat. You know, the idea is to make sure we don't send innocent people to jail and make sure we don't let guilty people go free.
I know you talked during your campaign about how you weren't trying to go in there to clean house and get rid of people for the sake of getting rid of mm-hmm. people. You mentioned that some longtime employees have stuck around to work with you. How many longtime employees of the prosecutor's office left when you started? How much hiring did you have to do?
So the office has 200 positions, and 80 of those are support staff. So they're civil servants. 120 are lawyers. And of those lawyers, within 1 month after the election day, I had gotten notice from, I want to say 32, and then I asked three people to leave. So that was about 35 people, and that was a challenge. Lucky for us, we did have the month of December to hire enough to keep us open, and we haven't missed a beat. We've been able to staff all 30 courtrooms in the courthouse. We've been able to staff juvenile court fully, court of appeals, the grand jury. It's been exciting sometimes to do that. And now we're at the point where we are starting to let people move to different positions within the structure of the office. Someone might want to go from municipal law court to juvenile court. We've had a couple promotions within the felony court. Our promotion process has changed. That's another thing. It used to be based on time and service, but now it's based on merit. So people have to apply and compete for promotions. And when I mean a promotion, so in our felony division, we have, I think, 30 lawyers, might be 32, and we break them into five teams, and then there's one of them as a team leader. So we've had some team leader openings, and so we've had people compete for those. One person who's an assistant team leader is Elise Dieters, who's the daughter of Joe Dieters. Mm. So I know people thought I was going to come in and just take a sledgehammer to everyone with an R after their name, but that was never my intention. And I think the fact that I've kept so many and promoted some and put some in different positions because that's where they wanted to be, And they were qualified to do so. I think you'll see I'm trying to use the assets that I have. And look, I want to make them better lawyers. That's why I have a training program.
What are you looking forward to next? I mean, what are your next big priorities for the office? I know these first 100 days have been, it sounds like a nonstop sprint. What are you looking ahead to?
Well, I have a couple of big projects. First of all, I want to move into the next phase of our technology upgrade, and that's going to be a much bigger project. It's our case management system, which is just an electronic file of the case. There is a case management system in effect. It's been there longer than I've been practicing law, so that's 26, 27 years now. So it's pretty out of date. We need to catch up with the other 70 counties in Ohio that have moved up to a more modern system. So we'll be working on that. That's going to take about a year and a half to implement. I plan to create an ethics officer. I think we need ethics for a bunch of reasons. I hear the conversations in the hallways in my office. I had these conversations in private practice. Sometimes you come across ethical decisions or dilemmas, and you need a safe place to get unbiased advice on how to handle it. And while my leadership team is doing their best, they got a lot of other things to do, and we need someone who is highly trained in the rules of professional responsibility. And so that's going to be someone who's going to be there. I also want to create my conviction integrity unit, which is on the campaign. I called it an audit, just to be a little more clear that I want it to be an internal process where we can review a big trial that just happened. Let's make sure for teaching purposes that we really did get all the evidence we're supposed to get from the police, that we really did turn it over, that we really didn't ignore witness statements, things like simple mistakes that can happen if you're new at your job or not very experienced, or maybe it's the first time you're handling a murder case and your mentor couldn't be there, so things like that. But that's going to take some. I'm going to have to get some funding for that, so that's going to be a little bit harder.
You mentioned you didn't want to just go in there and get rid of everybody. You had an R after their name. You're trying to have this office operate on merit, not politics. But Hamilton County has become a lot more Democratic. We've got more Democratic judges. Do you think that could change the way we see justice, you know, kind of meted out in the county?
That's a really hard question to answer. While we do have a lot of Democratic judges, judges are judges, and they run their courtrooms the way they feel is best. My job is to make sure I send talented people in there to prosecute these cases and that I make sure they're not taking shortcuts. And I know that a lot of the people in this office who've been there for a while, they're not the problem. They're not the problem. But when you handle as many cases as we do, I told you like 8,000 felonies, it's over 30,000 misdemeanors. It's just a huge number of cases that go through the court system every year. And you have to do the best you can. So for me, that means giving my attorneys the tools they need. It means telling them that I expect you to behave with integrity and that you have an open door for any issues of professional responsibility. And I think if we do that, at least on our side of the equation, we can improve justice outcomes.
Well, I have been talking with Hamilton County Prosecutor Connie Pillage. Thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations on day 100.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Up next, we'll hear from an Ohio lawmaker who wants to ban the addition of fluoride to public drinking water. This is Cincinnati Edition.